promptly at 2. I wanted to give you a little briefing on what the rules of the road are this morning, because we have some peculiar procedures. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to give you a little rundown on what the procedures will be this morning. As you can see, we've taken some elaborate precautions because of the possibility of contamination of the crew. I'd like to read a little statement by Dr. Charles Berry, which helps to explain why some of these precautions have been taken. The statement is by Dr. Berry and will be available in the newsroom after the press conference. I see some people are wearing hospital masks. That's your own option. That is not required. Dr. Berry says this in response to our questions and some of your questions about why we're going through these procedures. The possibility of inadvertent exposure of the crew to infectious disease in the pre-flight period has been of continuous concern to those of us responsible for crew health. In order to reduce this potential exposure to the minimum, a preventive medicine plan has been put into effect. Most disease incubation periods are covered by a 21-day time span. Thus, the plan calls for a limitation of contacts during the 21 days immediately pre-flight. The consequences of exposure and development of illness, either pre, in, or post-flight in this mission, are very costly. Pre-flight illness could cause delay past our lunar launch window. In-flight illness could preclude our accomplishing the lunar landing and surface activity in in-flight after the lunar landing. And in-flight, that is after the lunar landing, or post-flight illness, could prolong the 21-day post-flight quarantine, for we must be able to assure the world that such illness is not of lunar origin. The press conference and the interviews are being held 11 days pre-flight. Most agents of concern come from direct contact or droplet spread from nose and mouth. In view of the consequences of disease in the crew, we have asked that particular precautions be taken for these conferences. The laminar flow booth in the general press conference, which the crew will enter and depart in masks, booth, and the use of isolation facilities in the lunar receiving laboratory afford the best assurance of limiting exposure and conducting necessary activity. This was particularly asked. No control of exposure is perfect. It is impossible for us to totally isolate the crews during this busy period. Necessary contacts such as families, trainer, medical, and crew quarters personnel are carefully briefed before the report. What? All right. They are carefully briefed to report any illness in themselves or their contacts and are checked on a continuing basis. Your continuing understanding in accomplishing the difficult task of protecting the crew from potential illness is essential to the success of Apollo 1. That was Dr. Berry. We would also ask, please observe the rope. Obviously, we have to ask for your help on this. There's no way for us to surround the crew. They will come in here and go into the booth, and they will go out this way. We'll have to ask that you stay behind the rope. There will be a period at the end of the press conference for still photos, and the crew will stay for those pictures. So, and they've been briefed about this beforehand and know it's coming. So we'll try to get the best we can out of the 60 minutes. But we have to be very careful with this contact situation.
I'm told there were too many people talking out in front. 1, 2, 3. Well, we've checked this very carefully all morning. I'm sure it's better. I don't have any.
That's what I mean. We've checked the lavaliers in there very carefully.
Yeah.
flag behind the astronauts is a prototype of the flag which would be used on the surface. By the astronauts, and then go directly to question and answers.
Bill,
you may have to tell them. They can't hear me. Apparently they can't hear me in theirs. Neil, we're ready anytime you are. We can open with a statement and then go directly to question and answers.
Well, we're here today to talk a little bit about forthcoming flight Apollo 11. Hopefully the culmination of the Apollo national objectives. And we are here being able to talk about this attempt because of the success of four previous Apollo manned flights and a number of unmanned flights. Each of those flights contributed in a great way to this flight. Each and every flight took a large number of new objectives and large hurdles and left us with just a very few additions, the final descent, lunar surface work, and ascent to be completed. We're very grateful to those large effort of people here at MSC and across the nation who made those first flights possible, successful, and made it possible for us to sit here today and discuss Apollo 11 with you. I'll ask Mike first to talk about the differences you might see in the command module activities on this flight.
From the command module viewpoint, I hope there'll be very little different on this flight than from its predecessors. Dave Scott and John Young have run through approximately the same sequence of events which will take place for me on Apollo 11, with the exception that the solo period will be somewhat extended on 11. I will be in the thing by myself for slightly over one day, and that will include a sleep period. So in some respects, that particular portion of the Apollo 11 flight plan more closely resembles for example, Gordon Cooper's Mercury flight, where he was up by himself for 30-some hours. The rendezvous has the capability of being somewhat different in that the starting point with the LEM on the surface is a far cry from the preceding rendezvous, where the relative position of the LEM and the command module were very precisely known, having started out from the same little point in the sky together, whereas in this case the command module obviously is whizzing around the moon while the LEM is stationary on the surface, and this offers a possibility of rendezvous sequences which could differ significantly from normal. So I think those are probably the two major areas in which this flight is somewhat different, again strictly from the command module viewpoint. Another interesting point to note is that although I'm called the center seat man, in fact I don't ride in the center seat. I ride in either the right-hand seat for launch or the left-hand seat for the Burns entry and the other major flight plan events. Buzz?
We do have a few new items on the LEM side of the house on this particular mission. We'll be picking up where the Apollo 10 flight left off when they did their phasing maneuver. And at this point, after departing the command module, coming down in the descent orbit, we'll be igniting the descent engine for the first time under a long burn condition when it is not docked with the command module. And executing this burn under control of the computer, being directed toward the various targets that are fed into the computer, will be new on this flight. Also, we'll be making use of the landing radar and its inputs into the computer, inputs in terms of altitude and velocity updates, which will bring us down in the prescribed conditions as we approach the surface of the moon. Of course, the actual control of the touchdown itself will be a rather new item in that it will be testing this man-machine interface to a very sophisticated degree. The touchdown itself will test be the ultimate test on the landing gear and the various systems that are in the spacecraft. The environment of 1/6G will be seen for the first time by crews and spacecraft. We'll also be exposed to thermal conditions that have not been experienced before. The two-man EVA is something that is a first in our program. Sleeping in the LEM on the lunar surface, which we hope to be able to do, will be another new item in this flight. Making star sightings with the alignment telescope to position the, or correctly determine the attitude of the inertial measurement unit in the LEM vehicle will again be done for the first time. This is a new technique that's used on the lunar surface. And then, of course, the powered ascent with the over 7 minute burn on the ascent engine. These things are the new items that we'll be seeing on Apollo 11. They will bring us back up to that point in the Apollo 10 flight where they had their insertion maneuver. From that point on, we hope that the rendezvous will go as smoothly as it did on that flight. In preparing, of course, for all of these conditions and various contingencies that can develop, we have faced a much wider variety of trajectory conditions that could result, as Mike has mentioned, and lead to a wide variety of conditions of maneuvering spacecraft to bring them back together again. It's in these areas that I've been talking about that Neil and I have been concentrating most of our efforts, since these are the new items on our flight. The other portions of the flight plan have been pretty well worked out by the previous flights, and of course without those procedures having been worked out as well as they have, of course we would not be in the position to fly this mission.
I guess that's all, Brian.
We're ready for questions now. I ask you each to wait for the microphone and remind you that those organizations with individual interviews after the press conference, please don't ask questions here. We have one here.
Human life and less costly, of course. Now, what particular gain do you see that you as human beings go there to the moon yourselves and for your country and for mankind as a whole? And do you think that eventually the moon will become a part of the civilized world just as the Antarctic is now, which was also once a remote and inaccessible place?
I missed the first part of your question due to the inaccurate sound system, but I think I understand the gist of the question. And first, let me repeat something that you've all heard before, but probably addresses itself to your question. That is, the objective of this flight is precisely to take man to the moon, make a landing there, and return. That is the objective. There are a number of peripheral secondary objectives, including some of those you mentioned early in your question, that we hope very highly to achieve in great depth. But the primary objective is the ability to demonstrate that mankind, in fact, can do this kind of a job. How we'll use that information in the centuries to come, only history will tell. I hope that we're wise enough to use the information that we get on these early flights to the maximum advantage possible. And I would think that in the light of our experience over the past decade, that we can indeed hope for that kind of a result.
Jean-Pierre Chapelle, French TV News. What will be, according to you, the most dangerous phase of that fly of Apollo 11?
I think, was the question, the most dangerous phase? Well, as in any flight, the phases that give one most concern are always those which have not been done previously, things that are new. And I would hope that in our initial statement we gave you an idea, at least, of what the new things on this flight are. Now, there are other things that we always concern ourselves about greatly, and that is those situations where we have no alternative method to do the job. We have only one. You, when you ride in an airliner across the Atlantic, depended on the wing of the airplane to stay on the fuselage. Without it, you could not have made the trip safely. There would be no recourse. Now, we have, on recent flights, have had some of those kinds of situations. In our lunar flights, the rocket engine for the service module must operate for us to return from the moon. There are no alternatives. Similarly, in this flight, we have several situations like that. We have the ascent engine must operate to accelerate us from the lunar surface into lunar orbit, and the service module engine, of course, must operate again to return us to Earth. And as we go farther and farther into spaceflight, of course, there'll be more and more of these single-point systems that must operate. We have very high confidence level in those systems, incidentally, or we would certainly object to starting.
One on the far side.
Mr. Armstrong, I wonder if you and Colonel Aldrin could tell us how much walking you're going to do while you're on the moon, how far away from the LEM you plan to walk, and what sort of gait you think you'll be using. We were told the moon looks like pretty good ankle-breaking territory, and we wondered, for instance, how you might avoid turning an ankle, falling down, or slipping, things of that nature.
Well, Buzz will be doing a good bit of the mobility studies early in our lunar surface activity. I'll let him take a crack at that question.
Well, first off, most of the planned activities that we have do not require us to move more than 50 to 70 feet away from the lunar module. Now, one of the early activities that I'll be engaged in after descending the ladder is, in addition to a rather preliminary evaluation of just how well a man can handle himself in a spacesuit on the surface, one of these things will be called EVA evaluation. Now, as part of this, I'll be determining what is the best pace for moving about, and there have been several different techniques employed in the partial zero gravity trainer, the POGO machine, and it looks like you can walk conventionally one foot after another. It also looks as though you can do a two-footed hop, kangaroo style. Now, we don't really think that this will be the best means, but it does look as though this is possible. As the G-force decreases, I think we have a greater freedom to be able to come up with body movements that are a little bit different than what we're used to in 1G. Now, I think one of the things that we have to be careful of is the balance situation in moving about on the surface. We always have to be able to put a foot underneath where you happen to be, and of course the time period from when your foot leaves the surface till when it comes back down again is going to be longer than it is in a pace, walking pace, or a trotting pace sort of on the earth. And of course this gives the rotational disturbances more time to have an effect. In doing some of the training in these zero-G airplane, which has been flying at the 1/6G for this phase of it, it looks as though it, a fairly rapid pace, I'd hesitate to call it a run, is quite easy to perform, and it looks like we shouldn't have too much difficulty in moving at something like 6, 8, 10 miles an hour. But this is one of the tasks that we'll be attempting to evaluate very early in the EVA.
I have one down here in the corner.
For Neil Armstrong, by the nature of your assignment, if you carry it out successfully, you're destined to become a historical personage of some consequence. And I'm wondering if in that light you have decided upon something suitably historical and memorable to say when you perform this symbolic act of stepping down on the moon for the first time.
No, I haven't.
I hope he doesn't say, oops, I slipped.
Good one back here.
Mark Bloom, New York Daily News. I have a question for Neil Armstrong, if I may. Being the first man to step on the moon, the prospect is possibly that you'll be such a celebrated personality for the rest of your life that you'll never really have again what you might call a personal life. Do you have any thoughts on this prospect?
Well, I suppose if there's any recognizable disadvantage to being in the position I'm in, that's it. I think that's a fair trade.
I have one over here.
I'd like to ask two questions. One, the command module and the lunar module are going to be named or by what you've been using in the simulations?
I think you're referring to the call signs of the spacecraft when they're separated, so
that's
that we
correct.
Don't confuse
yes.
the spacecraft on radio transmissions. Yes, we do intend to use call signs other than those that you may have observed in simulation. Call sign of the lunar module will be Eagle. Call sign of the command module will be Columbia. Columbia. Now, those names, both names, were suggested by a number of people. Very many large number of other names were also submitted for our consideration, many of which were quite good. We selected these two as being representative of the flight and the nation's hope. Columbia is the national symbol. It's Columbia stands on top of our capital, and as you all know, it was the name of Jules Verne's spacecraft that went to the moon 100 years ago.
Let's catch some of these right in here.
Name is Tanberg. In case you find out you have to cut short your EVA, what will be the priority of the different tasks you plan to perform on the surface? And second, what kind of surface temperatures do you expect?
I'll take a crack at the first one. Our order of priorities was carefully integrated into the flight plan so that the most important things came early in the EVA, and within operational limitations, the priorities reflect the order of things as they're done on the lunar surface, which means that should we have to cut that time short, the most important things would have been completed. Want to take a crack at temperatures, buddy?
No.
Reg Turnell, BBC. A question for Neil Armstrong. It was reported by a former NASA official recently, who isn't sitting 100 miles away from me, that you, Mr. Armstrong, exercised your commander's prerogative to step first on the moon instead of Buzz Aldrin. Could you please tell us what the facts are about this? And on a lighter note, could you tell us whether when you step on the moon you'll have had a shave?
I read one article to which you alluded, and it didn't state specifically that the gentleman had said that I had done that. He said that I may have or could have or something to that effect. Facts are that my recommendation was never asked nor given. We do hope to carry a razor aboard, and whether or not we use it is a matter of pilot option at the time, and if we feel so inclined, I would hope that that would be done.
Torian of the Swedish Broadcasting. In the lighter way in here, you're now taking the trip of all trips of mankind. Can I ask each one of you, which place would you like to go to for a vacation when you come back to Earth?
Well, I think that the situation being what it is now, the place I would most like to go immediately is the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. If I'm able to go there, we will have succeeded.
I wondered if each of the three could tell us very briefly how your families have reacted to the fact that you're taking this historic mission.
Well, who wants to take a crack at that?
Well, I think in my particular case, my family has had 5 years now to become accustomed to this eventuality. And over 6 months to face it quite closely. And I think they look on this as a tremendous challenge for me. They look upon it also as an invasion somewhat of their privacy and a removing of my presence away from the family for a considerable period of time. I'm not sure exactly whether this is the overriding feature over and above some of the other more pleasant aspects of the particular job that I have as far as it affects my family.
Neil, Marvin Miles, Los Angeles Times. I'd like to know, I understand that you're going to take manual control of the descent. Can you tell us at what point, how low you will take that control, how far you will burn down, and how low you could stage an abort and go to apps if necessary?
We have made some significant improvements in the flight control system and the computer's interaction with that system in recent months. allows us to go into somewhat hybrid methods of manual and automatic. The predicted method at this point, although we have a great deal of flexibility and choice based on the situation of the time, would be to maintain manual control of attitude and automatic control of throttle through the final descent from an altitude of somewhere between 500 and 1,000 feet until such time as the automatic throttling rate of descent was unsatisfactory, at which time we'll go full manual on the throttle, that is rate of descent command on the throttle, which is operating through the computer. Should that become unsatisfactory, then we can go to a full manual throttle, flying it in a manner like a normal VTOL machine would be flown. So 500 feet is a good...
That one down here.
James Burke, BBC. You have mentioned that your flight, like all others, contains very many risks. What, in view of that, will your plans be in the extremely unlikely event that the lunar module does not come up off the lunar surface?
Well, that's an unpleasant thing to think about. We've chosen not to think about that up to the present time. We don't think that's at all a likely situation. It's certainly a possible one. But at the present time, we're left without recourse should that happen.
Colonel Aldrin, on Apollo 8, you were the command module pilot in the backup crew, and this one, you're the lunar module pilot. How interchangeable in your preparation for this, or for that matter, in the flying of it, are the roles of the crew?
Well, at the stage that we're at right now, I think they're not very interchangeable. Prior to my assignment as backup command module pilot on Apollo 8, we were together as in slightly different roles, and it was, if I'm not mistaken, because Mike was dropped out of the mission, that we had an adjustment of the crews that put me from the lunar module pilot into the command module pilot's position. For Apollo 8, there was no lunar module, so this was not much of an adjustment. It was just moving from an emphasis on systems to more in navigation. Now, since I had previous training to some degree in the lunar module, why then moving back into that position was not too difficult a task.
Everyone on the far side.
Mr. Armstrong, earlier there was some concern expressed that you were rushed to get in all your training necessary for this flight. What is the state of your training readiness now?
The reason that was a concern is that the final training for a crew is the last thing that takes place. In other words, the procedures must be developed and the simulations completely set up and the simulators ready to fly and the checklists made and so on before the final training can take place. And these, of course, were the pacing items, these intermediate things to the final training. At this point in time, we have a high confidence level that the procedures and checklists, simulations that we are now operating are correct and will fly the mission the way they are now detailed. So of course there was a good deal of concern in our own minds and many other people in the organization that all these things for the descent, ascent, surface work would fall into place in time. We do feel at this point that we've been very fortunate in having those things make the schedule along with the hardware, which of course is on the pad now and ready to fly.
Mr. Shelstead.
You were speaking a few minutes ago about naming the spacecraft Columbia and so on. Do you have any plans to name the site where you land? That is to say, the immediate area where you land. Will you give it any name or not?
As on previous flights, we, in the absence of official names for various locations and landmarks on the lunar surface, have chosen to use some unofficial names for our recognition purposes and for our training purposes, and we'll continue to do that.
One more over here.
Mr. Armstrong, there's been some discussion of the possibility that with almost 10 hours interposed between the time of the landing and the scheduled moonwalk, that crew may become a little bit impatient and may start early. How do you now assess that situation?
Well, in the past, I guess, on our flights, we've demonstrated a somewhat more than average ability to change our mind and do things late or early or shift things around, maintain as much flexibility as possible. And I suppose that we would like to maintain that possibility now. Before the flight, we'd like to try to do just the opposite, get things set as firmly as possible in all our procedures and then attempt to stick with them. But should the circumstances of the time indicate that we can better achieve our objectives by using the information that we're gaining at the time we're doing things, then we'd certainly like to reserve that possibility, and I certainly wouldn't like to discount that at this time.
One right here.
Jorge Ruiz Aguilar, Núcleo Radomil, Mexico. Besides the scientific equipment that you will leave on the moon, are you taking any other item representative of the United States, like the United States flag or anything else? Second, besides the contribution to the science and technology progress, in your opinion, what will be the greatest benefits for humankind that will be achieved by the men in the conquest of the moon?
You want to talk about the objects?
We will be taking three items to the surface with us, which will be left there as symbolic of our arrival. The first is a plaque that perhaps you have heard about. This has pictures of the two hemispheres of the Earth. It has a statement on it: here men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969 AD. We came in peace for all mankind. And there are our three names and signatures, and the signature of the President of the United States. And this plaque is mounted on the main landing gear leg, the one that comes out the front of the spacecraft, the same one that we will descend down the ladder. The ladder is attached to this. The second item that will be left on the surface is it's a disc or a wafer between 1 and 1.5 inches in diameter, and it bears messages of goodwill from heads of state of various nations in the world. And I don't know what all these messages are, but they are in the process of being prepared in microcircuitry techniques. And the third item to be left on the surface is the United States flag, a very close replica of both the staff and the flag is behind the three of us.
Right here.
Caputo of Epoca magazine, Milan. What freedom do you have in deciding how far you can go from the lunar module? If you feel well and you see that walking on the lunar surface is simpler than it was thought originally. How far are you allowed to go?
We have no limitation. First, let us say, as Buzz may have indicated earlier, there is no requirement on the specific objectives that we're meeting on the surface to go great distances from the spacecraft, and to do so would only utilize time that we now have programmed doing things in the specific mission objectives. However, should there be an item of unusual interest in the nearby area that would warrant inspection at the expense of other of our planned tasks, we would certainly want to retain the freedom to make that inspection, and within our ability to get to the location necessary to do that, why, we would certainly like to. I can't at this time say what such an object might be, but if it were an animal, I'm quite sure we would zip over there and take a look. Or maybe we'd go the other way.
John Heberle, French TV News. This is a question for Buzz Aldrin. How can you figure out the chances of total success of moon landing and liftoff as far as the LEM and all systems in the LEM are concerned?
I would figure the chances are quite high. To be more specific, I wouldn't have the first idea to go about really how to calculate these. I think the fact that we've had considerable success in our vehicles is indicative of what we hope will follow. We certainly have the utmost confidence of total success.
We have one in the front row here. Is that one behind you? Doug, back, second row.
I would like to know what kind of surface do you expect on the moon? For example, color, the size of particles, or size of boulders, and so on. I'd like to know Mr. Armstrong's opinion and Mr. Aldrin's opinion, both.
Well, fortunately, we don't think we have to guess. I suspect we may be surprised in some detail, but the color is something that is predicted to be gray. Now, various crews in the past have called this bluish gray and brownish gray and greenish gray and maybe slight shades of tans and so on, but we suspect that those colors will manifest themselves in close inspection. The size of the particles will probably be largely very small, sandy, fine particles, but we do hope and expect to see some rock fragments, and I have no idea what size they might be, but we would anticipate that we'll have be able to bring samples back up to and including the size of a golf ball. There may be larger rocks in the vicinity, but we wouldn't expect to bring back samples, large samples.
I think both the answers to your questions have pretty well been borne out by the surveyor program, indicating a very fine grain cohesive material with an abundance of varying sizes and varying shapes of a harder rock material. And the colors, I'm sure, upon close inspection will be a little bit different, perhaps, than just plain gray. I'm sure there will be some definite color to the crystalline structures of the rocks.
I have a two-part question. One, have either any of you had any colds, sniffles, gastrointestinal upsets, or anything else in the past month? And two, are you carrying anything at all new or different in your medical kits this time?
I don't think we've had any illnesses in the crew. Can't say that we may not have individually had a sniffle or a stuffed up nose sometime in the past month or two. that may be the case. I don't know that, I'm not sufficiently familiar with the medicines carried in 10 and 9 kits to say that there's anything different in ours. Does anybody know? I don't think that there are. If there's any new differences, they're small ones.
The motion sickness pills have changed their chemical composition slightly. They used to be Marazine, and now they're a combination of Dexedrine and some other thing I can't recall the name of, but I'm sure the medics would be happy to provide you that information.
I'd like to ask Neil Armstrong if he agrees with a congressional mandate which specifies that the U.S. flag and only the U.S. flag be implanted on the moon on Apollo 11.
Well, I suspect that if we ask all the people in the audience and all of us up here, all of us would give different ideas on what they would like to take to the moon and think should be taken. Everyone within his own experience, and I don't think that there's any question about what our job is. Our job is to fly the spacecraft as best as we can, and we never would suggest that it was our responsibility to suggest what the United States posture on the moon would be, and I think that's probably within that decision has been made where it should be made, namely in the Congress of the country. I wouldn't presume to question it.
Ellis, Swate, Beaumont Enterprise. On previous moon flights, astronauts have been pretty busy with such maneuvers as docking and rendezvousing, this sort of thing. I presume as rehearsal for this trip. Am I correct in assuming this time that your flight up will be relatively quiet?
Did you catch that question? I'm sorry, I couldn't understand the question.
On previous moon flights, the astronauts have been busy with such maneuvers as docking and rendezvousing and this sort of thing. In rehearsal for this particular flight, will it be a minimum of that sort of thing on this flight?
Well, they're certainly equally important to this flight as they have been to all others. I think the only difference is that due to the work done on the previous flights, we probably did not need to concentrate so much on those phases in our training, nor will we be should we be surprised if those activities go as we plan them to go.
Nick Chris with the Los Angeles Times. I know your main concern now is only getting to the moon and getting back, but I wonder if you could tell us just briefly what you think the role of the country space program is going to be in the next few years and what roles you would like to play in it. Where it's going, in other words, not after the next lunar shots, but 5, 10, 8 years from now.
That's a very big question, and one, the subject to which a good deal of attention has been directed in recent months, and part of our agency and the Department of Defense and the Space Council and the administration and the Congress. And there's a very active interest by the people of the nation, too, in what direction this effort that has been mounted over the last decade shall be pointed. I wish that I could have had the time in recent months to listen to those discussions and participate in them. I suspect that many of you are much more up to date than we are in terms of those kinds of programs. I certainly think that the direction that we will go is beginning to gel. I see evidences at our level that people are
beginning to home in on things that look practical. I don't know what those agency and national decisions will be at this point, but certainly all the front runners, the space station, the space shuttle, the lunar shuttle, advanced lunar exploration, and the early planetary explorations are the contenders to reckon with, and I certainly think that those will be the ones from which our early goals are selected.
Daily Mail, London. Two questions. Firstly, what precautions have been taken at your own homes to prevent you catching germs from your own families? And secondly, is this the last period you'll spend at home here with your families?
Take crack at that, Mike.
My wife and children have signed a statement that they have no germs, and yes. Yes, this will be the last weekend that we'll be home with our family. So seriously, there are no special precautions being taken. I suppose if one of the kids came down with measles or some childhood disease which we had not had previously, then we would take measures to separate ourselves from them. However, in the absence of some overt evidence that they're ill, we are taking no precautions.
Two questions. What do you anticipate will be the most difficult task that you have to perform during your walk on the moon? And second, what do you plan to do in your spare time when you're back in the LRL, when you're cooped up all this time in between debriefings and business?
With regard to the first question, most probably the most difficult part of the lunar surface work isn't on the surface, it's in the LEM cockpit. It's the preparation for the activities on the surface, and the work subsequent to the EVA when we again have to operate in a pressurized suit inside the lunar module cockpit. Those are certainly the most difficult, possibly the most tiring, and certainly the most potentially hazardous of the things that go on, not generally recognized by the average bystander, because it's difficult for those activities, those long preparation activities, to be adequately displayed to someone due to the close confines of the cockpit. But it's certainly, one that we view with a good deal of caution. One part of the flight that we do with extreme care, and one that at this point in time we have high confidence in success of. Now the second question with respect to the LRL, fortunately, I guess the activities will be very much like the activities subsequent to any other flight in terms of their mechanical detail. It is the post-flight schedule, terms of briefings, debriefings with various interested groups of the program will take place just as though they have on previous flights. The only difference will be that our communication will be via TV link and hard wire rather than face-to-face as we are here today.
I'd like to add one point to the first question. Difficult things in EVA should be anticipated. We have attempted to anticipate all difficult things and to make them as easy as possible. I think the most critical portion of the EVA will be our ability to anticipate and to interpret things that appear not to be as we expected them to be. Because if we don't interpret them correctly, then they will become difficult.
Mr. Armstrong, at the time you step down on the moon, what will be your overriding consideration and what will be your main concern?
Hmm. Well, immediately upon touchdown, our concern is the integrity of the lunar module itself. And it's probably wise to point out that immediately after touchdown, and as a matter of fact, for the first 2 hours after touchdown, we have a very busy time verifying the integrity of the lunar module and all its systems. Without that integrity, of course, we are unable to complete the remaining objectives, and we cannot safely continue with the lunar surface work, and we cannot safely again return to lunar orbit. So that, of course, is the most important thing, and it will evidence itself to you all here by a great deal of technical discussions about systems between the spacecraft and the ground during a time period when most people will be wondering, well, what does it look like out there, or what do you see? And we understand that desire for everyone to know those kinds of things that I'm sure we'll be eager to comment on, but reluctant to do so in the face of these more important considerations on which the success of the entire rest of the lunar mission depends.
Henri Bergeron, Radio-Canada, Montreal. First of all, a question to Mr. Collins. How will you be able to follow the activities during EVA? Will you have a visual monitor? And secondly, another question, could the EVA period be extended if everything goes real well?
Well, I have two different ways of listening to Neil and Buzz while they are in the LEM and also while they're out on the lunar surface. First, I have direct radio contact with them on very high frequency radio during a 13-minute period that I'm in view of them. I can talk to them when I can see them during this 13-minute period that the command module goes overhead. In addition to that, the ground relays on the S-band, our normal air-to-ground frequency, they relay to the LEM everything which I say to the ground and vice versa. All LEM communications go to Houston where they're turned around immediately and sent back up to me so that they hear everything I say within 5 seconds of the time I say it, and the reverse is also true. Now, the S-band is operable anytime I am within line of sight of the Earth, not necessarily the LEM, you see, so that out of each two-hour revolution, roughly 60% of the time I am in contact with the ground, and therefore I am in contact with the LEM. In regard to seeing them, I'm afraid my eyesight's not quite that good. They're too small to be seen from an altitude of 60 miles. There is a possibility, and we intend to explore it further, that the LEM itself will be visible from the command module. The flat sides of the LEM being made of a mylar substance which reflects sunlight gives us hope that that I'll be able to see a flash of light at precisely the proper sun angles when I am nearly overhead. And this, of course, remains to be seen.
I have a question for Mike Collins. What will the command module pilot be doing while the commander and the LEM pilot are on the lunar surface? Will you be doing any special experiments of any type or not while you're up there by yourself? This is while they're on the lunar surface.
I heard the first part. What will I be doing, and specifically the second part?
Are there any specific type of planned experiments that are new that you'll be performing while Neil and Buzz are on the lunar surface?
No, there are no... There are no experiments as such. As I said earlier, I hope to determine whether I can see the LEM from 60 miles up. And in addition, I hope to get some detailed navigational sightings on the location of the landed LEM. I will take some optical marks on the LEM if I can see it. And then these marks will be fed into the arithmetic of the computer, which will then be able to determine more precisely the exact latitude, longitude, and altitude of the LEM on the surface. But these really are not experiments as such. They're just part of the overall framework of trying to piece together exactly where the LEM is relative to the command module for the ensuing rendezvous. Other than that, I'll be doing housekeeping chores, of which there are many.
Shima, West German TV Channel 2. Mr. Armstrong perhaps tell us, is there any legal importance in getting down on the moon? I mean, if you are settled down there, would any area there be the property of the United States or a wider area, or is there absolutely no legal implication?
Well, I think we might refer to this plaque again in the last line. Says, we came in peace for all mankind. I think that's precisely what we mean.
For AM Swedish television. Neil Armstrong said before that it was rather unpleasant to think of the fact that, or the possibility that you would get stuck on the moon. What is the longest time, if the ascent stage doesn't fire? And I think Mike Collins said in an earlier interview that he would then have to just leave and go back to the Earth. What is the longest time you can wait between the not firing and the time when Mike Collins would have to go back, the time you would have to work on the moon then to fix whatever was wrong or try to fix it?
Do you have those numbers immediately at hand? I don't have the numbers. Would be a matter of a couple of days.
At what point in the timeline will the American flag be erected on the moon's surface?
What? It's going to take place when we are both early in the time period when we're both on the surface. In order to aid each other with the Unstoinen operation, and it also should be at the time period when we have the TV camera placed in such a position that it would be able to see that. I don't mean to sound discouraging, but I don't have high hopes that the picture that we'll be able to send you back from the surface will be nearly so good as those you've been looking at from in recent flights from the command module. The camera is somewhat different, and we're somewhat more restricted in the kinds of lenses and the kinds of that we can use and the kinds of lighting we have available to us and the resolution of the camera. And I suspect that you'll be somewhat disappointed with those pictures. I hope that you'll recognize that that is just one of the problems that you face in an environment like the lunar surface, and it'll be some time before you really get high quality lunar surface pictures back on TV link.
James Byrne
on the BBC.
Colonel Collins, to people who are not astronauts, you would appear to have the most frustrating job on the mission, not going all the way. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't feel in the slightest bit frustrated. I'm going 99.9 some percent of the way there, and that suits me just fine. I couldn't be happier to be right where I am.
I'd like to say in that regard that the man in the command module, of course, by himself has a giant-sized job to do. He has to run Buzz's job and my job along with his own job simultaneously, and in addition act as a relay to the ground and be available for any kind of questions that we have to ask him and any that the ground, and it's really about at least a three-man job, and I've the utmost confidence that Michael certainly not lack for something to do while he's circling around, and if he can't think of anything else, he can always look out the window to admire the view.
We're coming up on the hour. We've got time for one more question. Over there on the far side.
Yeah.
From your previous experience in the 2.5 hours or so that you're atop the rocket before actual blastoff, is this a period of maximum tension, rather like being in a dentist's waiting room?
I didn't quite get you. Would you repeat that question, sir?
Is the period when you're actually on top of the rocket just before blastoff, is this wait a period of maximum tension?
Speaking from past experience, I haven't found that to be the case in the Gemini series. You're usually quite busy in that time period, and it's one of the phases of the mission that we have a very high confidence level in. It's nothing new. It's things that have been done before and done very well on a number of occasions, and we're quite sure that booster will go.
We promise the still photographers a chance to get some pictures at the end of the press conference. We'd like to do that right now.
Make sure I get the